Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. My name is Sean Delaney and you can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it. On Thursday and Friday last, primary school principals from all over Ireland met at the City West Conference Centre in Dublin. The occasion was the annual conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network, the IPPN. One of the keynote speakers at the conference was Dr. Rob Evans, and Rob is my guest on this week's programme. Rob Evans is a psychologist and the executive director of the Human Relations Service in Wellesley, Massachusetts. His interests are in change and resistance to it in schools and organizations and on the challenges of leading innovation. When I met up with Rob, I began by asking him to tell me what his talk was about when he addressed Irish principals at the IPPN conference.
Well, it was about what I think of as coping with the real life dilemmas of being in the role. So for me, that means two things: thinking not just about how would I be a better principal, but what does it take out of me to be a better principal? In other words, what are the personal burdens of being in the role? And I use the word dilemma because I learned from a principal in the U.S. some years ago to make a distinction between dilemmas and problems. A problem being something, he said, that you fix, and a dilemma being something you cope with, but you don't fix permanently. It's built into life. So a problem would be like the silencer on your car is defective and you get it replaced, fixed. A dilemma would be like being a parent. It's incurable. You have children, but you have to let them go. You love them, but you could kill them. It's wonderful being with them. It's fabulous getting away from them. And you're not helpless. You cope, but you don't cope once and then it's done. And you're not surprised when you have to revisit. And too many educators that I know have been treating as problems things which are actually dilemmas. And then they're upset when the solution doesn't stay permanent, or they feel they haven't done enough or haven't done it right, when actually it's a sort of an issue that just is going to need to be revisited periodically. So I was trying to help them reset a context for understanding some of the kinds of concerns that I had heard about during the 2 days of the conference that everybody was so worried about.
And could you give an example of where a principal treats a problem as a dilemma? Well, or treats a dilemma as a problem.
Yeah, well, so there are dilemmas that are built into the role that people seem to imagine they could get past somehow if they only did the right thing. But things that are just always going to be there. So, for instance, many, many principals are treated sort of as though they were members of the clergy because everyone else, teachers and parents, for example, students always see them as in role. You're not a person who's shopping here and just bought a large bottle of whiskey in the store. You're the principal who just bought a large bottle of whiskey in the store. It's a burden. And you know, people said, I need to be someplace where they'll just see me as me. Well, that's never going to happen as long as you're the principal. You're going to be the principal. It's actually a source of influence, but it's a burden that you have to carry. It's not a problem that you can fix by explaining something to people, or it's just going to be there. If you have a teacher, for example, who's good at some things but not very good at others, but there's no chance of getting rid of this person, you're thinking, well, I ought to supervise them better so they become a better teacher. Well, there's a limit to how much of that you can really do, and you have to sometimes accept those sorts of limits and not say, well, if I were a better supervisor, all of my teachers would be splendid. And so it's partially a matter of, to be honest to me, accepting some of what you have to live with just because it's built in that way.
And do you think that there's any difference between the principal in that role and the chief executive of a small company or a small organization?
Yes. In the U.S., there's an endless onslaught of advice for school leaders from corporate people, and who imagine that school people don't really know how to lead and need to be much more like business. But I said to the conference here, every school I've ever been in, I've been in 1,700 of them, is more like a church or a house of worship than like anything corporate. And the business of it is raising the young. It's not selling widgets or services or whatever. The kinds of things you do, if you follow a teacher around for a day, the work you see them doing is pretty much close to what pastors do, not what someone does in a corporate office somewhere. So much of the work depends on relationship and connection, which is true about many jobs, but there are very few that are almost just totally about interaction between adults and children and among children and, you know, that kind of thing. So to me, it's always seemed very different. The motivations are different. I mean, people don't go into teaching for the money. So I don't see much utility. I finally wrote an article called Why a School Doesn't Run or Change Like a Business, because I was so tired of hearing on the boards of governors in many schools, you know, the business guys who think that their principal ought to be, you know, firing this one and, you know, hiring somebody. You can't fire a second grade teacher in the middle of the year. It causes havoc, you know? So to me, this was also part of what we were talking about. There needs to be a value in saying, no, we are different. Schools are different. They ought to be different. They have to be business-like enough to survive. I mean, you can't ignore it all. But it's not actually a business in the sense of trying to capture market share and, you know, the things that companies do.
You mentioned the word change there. Yeah. And I suppose a lot of innovation that's brought about in Ireland and elsewhere, I'd say, begins with the words, we live in a changing society, yes. Therefore schools must. How do you view change in education and in schools specifically?
This is something I spent years working on and wrote a book about and so on. And I'm not in the business of telling the schools what sort of changes they should be making. I do know a lot about what makes it difficult to implement changes. That is an area for me that I've spent a lot of time thinking and working about. Because schools, in my view, are harder to change than anything corporate. And in fact, the only things that are harder to change than schools are churches and houses of worship. And if you think about it, it makes sense. School is a conservative's business. I don't mean politically. It's a conservator's business. You raise the young to prepare them for the future, which is unknown. The only way you can do that is to teach them what is known now. So it's inevitably, if you will, a backward-looking enterprise in some ways. You can't teach what you don't know, right? And so the people who do it are typically people who are not risk-taking entrepreneurs. They're people who tend to look for a good professional home and to stay there. And they're people whose job, especially in this case here where we're talking about primary schools, whose job is to help the young, you know, kind of learn to take their place among the older. And that's a kind of work that doesn't change much, you know. And so it's not that schools don't change, and it's not that they shouldn't be creative. My view is the school can't ignore it, but it's not the same thing as having to adapt the way some other organizations do.
But if a school and the people who work in the school want to be creative,
yeah,
and want to be ambitious,
yeah,
to improve what,
yeah,
they're doing,
good.
What are the implications of what you're saying about change for that?
So when people want to do it, of course it's easier. Too often what's happened is that somebody thinks the schools ought to do it and then wants to impose on them a change which the school or the educators find unwelcome or whatever. And my experience about any sort of change, not just in schools, but certainly there, has been that how people respond to it, whether you're speaking of teachers or principals or anybody, depends hugely on the meaning of the change, not the change itself. So, for example, a new way of teaching, a new way of doing something, if it's seen as a different way to fulfill a mission we have always been involved in, It's different than if it's seen as, we have to do this because we were so bad doing that. And now we have to, you know, get out of the doghouse by doing this. People usually won't change without a combination of pressure and support. Pressure being anything that makes it harder to keep doing the old. Support being anything that makes it easier to try something new. If you only pressure them, they just dig in their heels and the resistance goes underground. If you're only friendly and supportive, they never change. They means us, we, anybody. And you need, and people need to know, why do we have to do this? What are we supposed to do? How are we supposed to accomplish that? And the last thing while I'm doing the sermon would be, an awful lot of what gets called change in schools is actually just addition. It's just adding something else. It's not replacing something. And most educators in the U.S., for example, and as far as I can tell here too, feel like an awful lot of what they've been told is change is just more.
So how can a principal respond to these additions that come their way and that increase inevitably their workload?
So it's hard when they don't have control over it. And I don't know enough about the system here to know exactly how that happens, but I know lots of principals in the U.S. and elsewhere, Canada and other places, where they're supposed to help implement something they actually don't approve of because the higher-ups have said that's what we're going to do, it's what we have to do. And so you're left in the kind of middle manager's position where you have not enough authority but too much responsibility. So I think the first thing to say is it's very hard. Secondly, most of the most successful school leaders I've ever known have always done pretty much what they want to do as much as they can, and have done what they had to do when they had to do it. It's amazing when you meet people and they're in the same job in the same kind of setting in the same kind of situation, and the one says, oh no, it's awful, but I have to do it, and the other one says, well, it is awful, and I don't do much of that. Most places in the world, it's getting harder to find a principal. Fewer of them are putting themselves forward to want to be a principal. So I always say to them, you know, be bolder. Do more of what you really think is right and matters. And if they don't like it, they can always sack you. And what will happen is somebody else will need you because there aren't enough good principals to go around in any country I've ever been in.
Do you think it's better for a principal to be optimistic or realistic?
Well, I don't know that we have much choice about that, to be honest. I'm a psychologist, and my experience is that some people are one and some people are the other. And the evidence is pretty clear when you look at the research that optimists often don't see things accurately. And the people who do see things accurately, realists, are more inclined to be depressed. And that's sort of the nature of life, I think. I'm a great believer in biting off what you can chew, as opposed to, I'll mix my metaphors, as opposed to trying to heal the sick and raise the dead. I meet too many good principals who are trying to do the second. I'm all for people being optimistic and hopeful. Actually, to me, the distinction is being hopeful as opposed to optimistic, because I actually left them yesterday with a quote about that from Václav Havel, who says that, you know, hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense to do even if it doesn't turn out well. And so what I like is to have principals who are, in that sense, hopeful.
Some people say we expect too much from schools, and others say we don't expect enough. Where do you stand?
Oh, I'm easily with the first. If you made the list of all the things schools are responsible for now that they didn't used to be, it's enormous. Secondly, by the time a child leaves school at 18, they've been in school 10% of their lives, if you count the hours, 10%. Now, I'm sure a good school has a larger influence than 10%, but I know it's not 85 or 90%. But if you made the list of things we expect them to do, the schools, and frankly, the non-school lives of kids, all kids, but in some ways, especially the most disadvantaged, but for all of them, are increasingly at odds with the sorts of values, habits, and characteristics schools not only want to teach, but depend upon to function. So, for example, if you were a school that you wanted your children to learn to work hard, to persevere, to be nice to other people, like that, there's very little happening in the non-school lives of kids that supports that. And every time we discover something new, bullying or whatever, it gets handed to the schools. So in the States, this is just incontrovertibly true. And most of the places I've been, I don't know Ireland, but so I'm a big believer that we have been expecting much too much.
You mentioned earlier about the principal and the fact that the principal is always the principal, and no matter where they are. What are the implications of that for collegial relationships with colleagues on the staff?
Well, it depends, of course. You have very small schools here with just four or five, teachers.
And even fewer sometimes.
Right, and you've got very large ones. But, actually, when you become a principal, there's a reason we make the jokes about it's lonely at the top. There's only one principal. And you may be friends with, you may be feel collegial with people who also work in the school, but they're not the principal. And it's only when the principals come to a conference like this that they are with their actual peers. The only other people who know what it's like to be in their shoes. If you imagine late July and ask yourself, what are many principals doing on their supposed couple of weeks of vacation? Well, what a lot of them are doing is interrupting their vacation to go back to school because they have to hire a new teacher because someone who was on maternity leave just wrote in that she's not coming back. They have very little sense of getting out from under. Now, they also love the role, so it's not by any means all awful. And part of what comes with the burden is the influence. So there are definite upsides here. But the collegial implications are often, even when you have good connections with those and others in the school, that it's lonelier.
Is it possible for a principal to get on really well with their colleagues?
Sure. And it's easier when the principal doesn't have to say things like, you need to get a little better at this, or you can't do that anymore, or whatever. But inevitably, we talked about this yesterday too, what comes with the role is what psychologists in my field would call becoming a parental transference object. This is psychological talk for the fact that all of us are likely to treat authority figures project on them some of the unresolved conflicts from our own parents when we were growing up. And there are many people, many, many teachers who will be fine about most of the relationship with the principal, but there's always something else there. So you're a principal, you're the world's warmest, most nurturing female, but you have one of your staff who had a cold, hostile, depriving mother. And so every time you have to say no to this person, she reacts as though you were cold and hostile and depriving, even though it's not actually true. You can't say to her, I'm not your mother. I'm sorry that went badly, but I'm not your mother. So there isn't any way that you're just one of the folks on a flat. That doesn't mean you can't be informal, friendly, well-connected, supportive, caring, lots of great things. But there's always a little something different, at least.
And is there anything that your colleagues can do to ease the burden on a principal?
By colleagues, you mean?
The teachers who are working in the school.
We had a good laugh about this. I said to them, so when's the last time, late on a Friday afternoon, one of your teachers rapped on your door and came in and said, I just couldn't go home for the weekend without telling you how grateful I am to you. And I want you to know that I say a prayer for you every weekend. And I often think to myself, and I say to my husband, I hope my principal's all right. People who haven't sat in the chair don't know what it's like to sit there. And it's not reasonable to expect them to do that. So we had a good joke about it because I asked them to think of something they were really good at and tell each other. And then I said, when's the next time somebody in your school is going to notice this and say something to you about it? And the answer is, when you die or retire. Then we'll have lots of nice things to say. But between now and then, it's sort of like, in some small way, it's sort of like a child thinking, well, what do they treasure about their parents? Well, they don't say a lot about that most of the time. So, going to be a principal, this is what I meant about a built-in dilemma. This is not fixable.
One of your books Rob, is called The Seven Secrets of the Savvy School Leader.
Yeah.
First of all, what is a savvy school leader?
So savvy is, first of all, the title is deliberately, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek, because I had it right up to here with management books that get published in the U.S. all the time, six secrets of that and four secrets of the other, and how to heal the sick and raise the dead, and three easy steps and stuff like that. But to me, savvy combines two things. One is a kind of authenticity in which the leader, the school leader, has a fundamental consistency in sort of what they believe and what they do. So these are people who know what they're about. They know of all the good things that one could do. They know which ones matter most to them and go after them. And the second component is essentially a kind of capacity to make stuff work. So in other words, not just pie in the sky dreaming, but a practical capacity to translate something into action. And what I was trying to do in the book, I actually wrote it in the end because I got tired of how much emphasis we've had in the States on giving principals more and more and more to do, and wanting them to take more and more courses to learn how to lead the more and more things they're supposed to. And I started seeing lots of good folks retire early. The applicant pools for principals in the U.S., in Australia, in Canada are declining because fewer people want to live that life and take that job. I gather there's some issue like that here as well. And I was interested in how would we make the job of the principal more doable instead of trying to give them more to do. So the savvy part would be to sort of cut down, cut through, and to try to focus on a couple of key things that have a chance of really a strong impact instead of trying to advance on all fronts at once and end up exhausted and worn out.
And what are the kinds of things that principals can do in order to
well,
be like that?
So one thing is actually to think much more actively about what they're good at instead of what they're not. Many, many people in education, I told them yesterday, are the sort of folks who almost chose the convent or the monastery, but they couldn't stand the prospect of the chastity. So they turned away and settled for the second most sacrificial job they could find. So they end up with most of the vows, not the chastity, although they're tired enough by the time they get home, they don't have much sex anyway. And they hit the poverty and the obedience and the duty and the guilt. And one of the things they don't do enough is think about, how would I do more of what I'm good at instead of beating myself up because I'm not good at something else? A second thing, and this it's actually interesting, if you ask people to make a list, what are you really good at? Hold on to that list, and now and then, not every day, ask yourself, how would I do a little more of one of those? I've been saying this for 20-plus years, but I just came across some interesting research that was showing that when the Gallup poll interviewed thousands of people and asking them sort of about their well-being, not just educating them, and what correlates very highly with a strong sense of well-being is having a chance every day to do what I'm best at. If you think about it, it applies all the way down to young children. Children who would go through school and never have a chance to do what they're best at are not going to be happy there. But the same thing's true of teachers and of principals. So the looking for the strengths and building is one thing. A second thing to me is important is to be clear about which key priorities matter most. The state can say whatever it wants. You have to do this and that and the other. But there's never enough time to do all those. And some are going to get left behind and some aren't. And I think it's better that a leader knows what she or he values most and makes that clear to everybody. Almost all of us would rather work for someone who's clear, even if we disagree with them, than someone who seems to be clear, we seem to agree with, but who isn't really clear. So there's that. I'm also a big believer in getting away, coming to conference like this, because it's the only time they actually overcome the loneliness and are actually with peers, as well as having the chance to learn some new things. And I'm a big believer in having people realize that if they want better balance in their life, to be healthier, that requires choice, not time management. So I'm a believer that people need to be able to say, yes, I haven't finished everything, but I've worked really hard, I've done what I can, and I'm going home.
When you say some of the things you've said there, one of the things that's coming into my head is you're thinking that a lot of a principal's work is proactive, whereas
no.
In practice, a lot of it is actually reactive.
No, most of it's reactive.
So how then does a principal get that balance if they're constantly reacting?
Well, actually, it turns out they have to be more assertive about saying, you know, no, I'm not here. So I'll tell you, this is an example. There's a superintendent of schools in the Houston, Texas Archdiocese, Catholic schools, and she's an Irish nun. She's a charming person. And a couple of summers ago, she was going to take her vacation and come back to Ireland, visit her family. And she brought her BlackBerry and her other kind of, and they were constantly emailing her and texting her and whatever. So the second summer, she said she was going, she was not taking anything. And her office was scandalized. What'll we do? She said, finally, she said to them, she said, just pretend I'm dead. And she knew that if they really needed her, they could call on the phone somewhere, right? But she was going to have a vacation. That's it. And they survived. And many, many people who lead things end up in a curious bind in which you feel, oh, my God, it's too much. The burden's too intense. It's not fair. But I can do it. And, in fact, I'm so important, I have to do it. And if I don't do it, it won't get done. And you have this kind of vicious circular, this cycle of, I'm so important, but it's too much, right? And you can't break that at some point if you're not willing to say, I can't do it all. The job is actually not doable. Some things are going to have to be let go, and I'm going to have to concentrate where I really feel. And if someone wants to say, you're not doing everything we ask, the only honest answer is, that's right, because it's not doable.
The challenges of being a school principal, as described by Dr. Rob Evans, who was a keynote presenter at the annual conference of the Irish Primary Principals Network last week. Well, that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I did record a longer interview with Rob Evans, and I hope to bring you that in a future programme. Thanks to Rob Evans for his time, and to my colleague Jean Meegan, who set up the interview. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event in a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programs on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.